So the upcoming holiday of Shavuot, which is now, we're in the home stretch, less than 2 weeks, we have a custom to read the book of Ruth. So the question, what I want to understand today, so why do we read the book of Ruth on Shavuot, the holiday that celebrates the revelation of Mount Sinai? Okay, so before we get into that, let's just understand historically who wrote the book of Ruth, where is it situated in terms of our history? So like everything in Jewish life, there are multiple opinions as to exactly the time setting, but the consensus is that the book was written by Samuel, the prophet. So when the Jews came out of Egypt, they were in the desert for 40 years, and then Joshua brought the Jews into the land of Israel, and that began a period of close to 500 years where they were, instead of having a monarch, which eventually we have King Saul and then King David, and we have the Jewish monarchy. Before that, we had a period of time where we had the judges. So somewhere in the period of the judges, we have the story of Ruth, written by Samuel. And so this is occurring. Picture, we're in the land of Israel, somewhere within, I would say that it's probably two to three generations before we enter into monarchy. So you have the book of Ruth, and the setting, the story, which I will tell you quickly. We'll just do a quick explanation of the story. But what we're trying to do here today is we're trying to understand what is the connection between the story of the book of Ruth and the holiday of Shavuot when God revealed himself at Sinai. So one possible answer is that the story helps us understand the lineage of King David, who was born and also passed away on Shavuot. But the question, of course, is there more to the story? What would the connection, what does it have to do with the giving of the Torah? So King David, so you have Jewish royalty, monarchy, and the giving of the Torah is very, it's kind of, how do those two connect? It doesn't seem to have any connection whatsoever. I mean, the idea that, let's say, King David was born and died on Shavuot, that's nice, but how does that connect us to a whole story of Ruth? And then, if you can tell me that the whole story is basically to be told just so that we know where King David came from, it just seems like it's too little for me to go on in terms of connections to say, okay, this is something, there's got to be more to it. In the title, this is based on a medrash, it says that where can you find the king of Mashiach? He can be found in the ashes of Sodom. Now, that story of Sodom, we have Abraham, his nephew Lot separates from him, and he leaves and he goes to the city of Sodom, which eventually becomes destroyed. It's destroyed by God because of their evil ways. So we need to understand, why did Lot go to that place of all places? And then what is it about Sodom that was so bad? And then on top of that, why is it that it's specifically from that place that the king of Mashiach, King David and his offspring, which eventually will bring us to Mashiach, has to come from that place of Sodom, right? It's an evil place where it seems like a horror show, a lot of bad things going on, to the point where God says, I can't tolerate this anymore. He has to destroy it. And from that, we're going to say the Mashiach comes from there. Okay, so now what do we have so far? So what we have is the book of Ruth being read on the holiday of Shavuot, somehow connects us to King David. But what does Jewish monarchy have to do with the idea of the revelation at Sinai. And then it brings us also from, if we're going to be talking about King David, as an offshoot, stone, the place of stone. From the ashes of stone, that's where the Messiah is going to come from. So I just want to look at a quick Mishnah from Pirkei Avot, which I think tells us a lot, or gives us a little bit of a glimpse into what stone is about. So it says in that, it's Avot chapter 5, Mishnah 10, says there are four types of character in human beings. One that says, mine is mine, and yours is yours. This is the commonplace type. It seems like, okay, Arba Midah Ba'adam, Ha'omer Shali, Shali, V'Shalcha, Shalcha, Zo Midah Be'inonis. It's like, it's kind of the middle of the road. But there are those who say, there's some that say this is the Sodom type of character, which is kind of surprising. It seems kind of reasonable to say what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. Doesn't seem like such a horrible thing. It actually sounds very reasonable. So to say that this is actually the attribute of Sodom is kind of shocking. Now, just to look a little bit further in the Mishnah, it says, one that says, mine is yours and yours is yours, is a pious person. Right? So if a person's willing to give away theirs, mine is yours and yours is yours, that's a pious person. In contrast, mine is mine and yours is yours, which on the surface seems very reasonable to say that what belongs to you belongs to you, what belongs to me, that seems to be very reasonable. If anything, that seems to be like common law, like how we approach things. How can you say that that's Midas Stone? That's the attribute, the character type of Stone. So the question brings us to Abraham and his nephew Lot. Abraham is symbolic. We understand Abraham is a very charitable, outgoing person who all he did all day or looked to do was to help others. His tent is open from all four sides. He's looking to bring in those who are traveling. He wants to bring in guests to take care of the guests. He runs to take care of the three ended up being angels, but the three that came to his tent, we see this active Abraham. He's a person of chesed, of loving kindness, of giving. His nephew, if we read the story of Lot, we see that Lot benefits and becomes wealthy because of his affiliation with his uncle Abraham, Avram. So what's interesting is that at a certain point, Lot's reaction to his reaction to his being always getting from his uncle, the person of chesed, he can't handle anymore. His reaction is, I can't stand anymore. I'm going to go to the antithesis of my uncle. I'm going to go to a place where it's not about getting things from others, but what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. That is Sodom. Sodom says that you only get what you deserve. It's to the opposite extreme. There is no such thing. It's anti-chesed. It's anti-loving kindness. It's anti-taking a handout. To the point where if you do that, they would come and they would kill you. Stone was a place of no charity whatsoever. Charity was completely not allowed. So when it's almost like impossible to, it's like the opposite of Abraham. Now, what's interesting is that we all started this discussion based on the idea that Mashiach is going to have to come from the ashes of stone. But what that basically means, though, is there's something in the stone approach to the world that's actually necessary. There's something about that that's going to be needed to build, to be a building block in the Jewish monarchy. Okay? So now, we leave that aside, but we have to understand, we need to understand that Ruth is coming from that place. Because who is Ruth? Ruth is the one that comes from Moab. Moab is the child that Lot has with his daughter. So after the stone is destroyed, we understand, or Lot and his daughters, they think that the rest of the world is destroyed. They get their father drunk, and they have sons. Each daughter has a son from Lot. The first one has a son. His name is Moab, and from that child, that's exactly where Ruth comes from the Moabites. So it's from that place of stone that we get ourselves to Ruth, okay? And somehow that's going to be an important building block in Jewish monarchy, okay? So now, just to like put it together, we're going to go step by step. Let's go back and start again. We're going to start, and we're going to go step by step. We're going to build something very important here. It's a very important lesson that we need to understand, to take away also about understanding about the Jewish monarchy. And the book of Ruth, four chapters, is so power-packed, we probably could spend multiple Sundays just going through it, line by line, and the depth of the nuance in the language to see many different things that are taught here. But we're just focusing on a couple of things today. We need to understand what is the connection between the book of Ruth and the holiday of Shavuot that's coming. The holiday of Shavuot commemorates the giving the revelation of the Torah at Sinai. So we're going to experience God's revelation. What does that have to do with Jewish monarchy and the story of Ruth? So first thing we did here is we said we just need to understand that Ruth is coming from a place of anti-chesed. She comes from a place of stone, which basically says, I only get what I deserve. Okay, that's a very important idea, that there needs to be, I'm not taking any handouts. I earn or I get what I deserve. If I do it, I deserve it, I get it. Otherwise, I don't get it. That's really what stone is about. When you take that attribute to the extreme, it gets to be destructive. But in its essence, right, when we look at the mission of it, and it describes this attribute of mine is mine and yours is yours, this is the commonplace type, in its balance, it's not such a terrible thing per se. Maybe if you operate as, I want to get what I deserve, and I don't want handouts, that's not such a terrible thing. We have other teachings that say we should not want to take handouts. A person who has a mindset of not wanting to take handouts is a good thing. So the idea of the midah of yours is yours and mine is mine and yours is yours, that's not a terrible thing. But when taken to extreme, it becomes the midah of stone, not a good thing. So, but we understand and we'll see. And we're not going to necessarily go into this in detail today, but when you go back and look at Ruth and you read about her, you'll see she has this attribute. She doesn't want handouts. So part of like what is the formation of the Jewish monarchy is that there's a need to do things to deserve what you get. We're not looking for handouts. Very important idea. Okay. But how does this come to, how do we get to the connection of the book of Ruth and the holiday of Shavuot of the revelation at Sinai? So we're going to look at here. I'm going to bring you two parts of the story. And we're going to look at them and understand there's something, there's a common theme between these two story points. And then we'll understand the connection back. And that'll be what we'll take away for today in terms of the connection between the holiday of Shavuot, the commemoration of the revelation at Sinai, and the book of Ruth, and what the lessons that are being conveyed here. Okay, so now, let's just do a quick... We're going to run through the story very quickly. There was a guy, his name was Elimelech. He had a wife, Naomi, and he had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They were the leaders. Elimelech was the leader he was a very important person, very prominent person that lived in the city of Beit Lechem of Bethlehem. There was a drought, and he left and he went to the enemies of the Jewish people. He settled in Moab. He took his wife Naomi, his two sons. He passes away. Naomi's left with her two sons, who then in turn marry Moabite women. They weren't just common folk; they were princesses in Moab, in that country, in that nation. Those two sons die, and Naomi's left with two daughter-in-laws who are incredibly faithful to her. They're very good to her. She hears that the salvation came to the Jewish people in Beit Lechem. She goes back and returns, and the two daughter-in-laws actually join her. One of them, at a certain point, Naomi says to both of them, "You guys should not stay with me. Go back." Orpah leaves her. Ruth says, "No, I refuse. I'm staying with you." We're about to read that story. And so it happens. Ruth comes with Naomi. They come back. And basically, at that point, Naomi is shunned. She is, they completely shun her. They have nothing. They're destitute. And then Ruth goes out to collect food as if she's a poor person, uses the charity system that is set up by the Torah. She goes into the field. She picks the grain that's left over in the fields. There's a person named Boaz. He hears about this woman, Ruth. Fast forward, he reaches out. He wants to redeem. He wants to basically marry her based on this idea of Yibum, in the English translation is forgetting how to translate Levirate marriage. There is someone else that actually comes who actually stands before Boaz in that line. Boaz brings it to a court. That person, who we call John Doe, Ploni Almoni, refuses to step up to the plate. Boaz then does. He marries Ruth. They have a child who ends up becoming the great-grandfather of King David. That's our story. Okay, so now, how does that story connect us to the revelation at Sinai? What's the takeaway? Okay, so let's look at the first glimpse of something. It's from chapter 1. So we said that Naomi hears that the things have changed in the land of Israel. So she's going back to the land of Israel. So here's where we get to our point, our story. Accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living, and they set out on the road back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Turn back, each of you, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that each of you find security in the house of a husband." And she kissed them farewell. They broke into weeping. So both of her daughter-in-laws and her, Naomi, start crying. And said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Turn back, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I any more sons in my body who might be husbands for you?" So the backdrop here is that there's an understanding that there is this idea of Levirate marriage, that whatever, that there would be others that would step up and marry these women to step into the shoes of the deceased. "But I don't have anybody like that," she says to them. "Turn back, my daughters, for I am too old to be married. Even if I thought there was a hope for me, even if I were married tonight and I also bore sons, should you wait for them to grow up? Should you, on their account, debar yourselves from marriage? Oh no, my daughters, my lot is far more bitter than yours, for the hand of the Lord has struck out against me." They broke into weeping again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell, but Ruth clung to her. So at this point, if you're going to ask, we see these two women, Orpah and Ruth, the daughter-in-laws, have tremendous devotion to their mother-in-law. They've actually both gone, I would say, they've both been incredibly loyal. And now their mother-in-law is saying to them, "Listen, guys, you need to go on with your lives. I don't have anybody that's going to be able to marry you. So I'm asking you to please go back." And Orpah finally says, "You're right," and decides to leave, which is very reasonable. Ruth, on the other hand, goes and says, "No," she clung to her. So Ruth is going beyond the call of duty. She's already now taken it to another level. So she said, see, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. Go follow your sister-in-law, Naomi says to Ruth. But Ruth replied, do not urge me to leave you, to turn back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Just as a parenthetical, that line is where she converts to Judaism, where she says, Amech, ami, velokayach, elokay, your people are my people, your God is my God. She's accepting upon herself. She becomes, there's a lot of literature based on this idea of the acceptance here of joining the Jewish people. Fine. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. Thus and more may the Lord do to me, if anything, but death parts me from you. Right? So she's pledging herself. She's gone beyond the call of duty. When Naomi saw how determined she was to go with her, she ceased to argue with her. So then Naomi accepts Ruth's incredible devotion. And the two went on until they reached Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole city buzzed with excitement over them. The women said, can this be Naomi? Do not call me Naomi, she replied. Call me Mara, meaning bitter. For God has made me my lot very bitter. So pretty much we get a sense of how bad. Can you imagine the devotion that Ruth had to this woman? She's willing to follow her, even to a point where she's literally, she's coming in, she's bitter. But nevertheless, we see this incredible devotion of Ruth. And then it continues that Ruth, and Naomi talks about herself, I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. How can you call me Naomi? How can you call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me, when God, Shakai, has brought misfortune upon me? Thus Naomi returned from the country of Moab. She returned with her daughter-in-law, Ruth the Moabite. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So the idea that they came at the barley harvest is, there's so many different things that are going on here. The idea of the barley harvest is that when we, the second day of Passover, we bring the barley offering that's called the Omer, and we lead for, we count for 49 days. It brings us to the holiday of Shavuot, which is, then we start going into the wheat. We go from barley, which is a low-end animal-type food, and we elevate ourselves to the, so in the backdrop of the Ruth story, we start to get a little sense of the settings really connects to our time of the year. Oops. Okay. So now, this first depiction in the chapter that we just read from a part of chapter one in Ruth, what we're getting here is a story of two women, Orpah and Ruth, two daughter-in-laws, that are both incredibly devoted to their mother-in-law. But at a certain point, we see that that they diverge. Now, the normal thing, almost like going back to like that Mishnah in Avot, that the normal thing would be like what Orpah did. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell, but Ruth clung to her. The normal expected thing would be what Orpah did. She went out. You see this incredible devotion that she has, but at a certain point, Naomi's like, what do you want from me? Go home, go back, have a life. And she continues on. What's interesting is that it's Ruth that goes beyond. She goes to a different level, okay? Let's look at the second example, and then we'll connect this back to our first question, right? We started this, and we're asking the question, what does the book of Ruth have to do with the revelation at Sinai? Okay, so there, on the surface, we said it connects somehow to the Jewish monarchy. I think we'll leave it aside, but just the book itself, we'll see how important the lessons that we learn today in terms of how it relates or how we should relate to the Torah. Okay, so now chapter four, we're already fast forwarding to the latter part of where Ruth came to Boaz, and he's so taken by her devotion to her mother, to what she's done for Naomi. He understands there's something so special about Ruth. As a side, as another thing to look at in the story, is we're going to see a change in the attitude of the people of Bethlehem, how they relate to Naomi at the beginning, and how they're going to shift in how they see her later on in the story. And so, okay, so Boaz, just as a side, so Boaz is related. So Naomi's husband, Elimelech, who passed away, is a relative of Boaz. And so that's how, even though he's not a direct relative, he's like he meaning there are those that are closer to Elimelech, Naomi's husband, in terms of like who would step in terms of who would inherit his. Elimelech had own land, and he passed away. That and then he lost his son, so he has no inheritor. Who would inherit the next in line was someone who ends up becoming Ploni Almoni, John Doe. We don't know his name. And then the next in line would be Boaz. So Boaz ends up the one who becomes the redeemer, and he ends up inheriting. He steps up and agrees to marry Ruth, and also Ruth is willing to go along with this as well. But what's interesting is that, okay, so we have to understand that there's one other piece that has to be added in here, that we have to understand why. You can imagine, think about this. The Torah tells us that one cannot marry someone from Moab. A Moabite cannot marry into the Jewish people. Why? Because when the Jewish people came out of the land of Egypt and they wanted to pass through the land, and they asked the Moabites to help them out with food, they were refused. The Torah tells us that because of that incredible lack of willingness to help, that it became a the Torah ordained commanded that or prohibited us from marrying with the Moabites. So you can imagine these are not our we're not, we don't feel any kinship with the Moabites. So the fact, if you go back to just chapter one, that last line there, when it says, "Thus Naomi returned from the country of Moab, she returned with her daughter-in-law in Ruth the Moabite," that's telling us something, that the author is saying that this is not kosher. This is like, the worst person that she could be bringing back is a Moabite. It's like, you're not allowed to marry Moabites. What ends up coming out of our story is that the restriction, the prohibition of the marriage with Moabites was limited to the males, that we can't marry a man from Moab. But from the way they understand the text, it was in the masculine. You can't marry the masculine Moabite, but the feminine you can. So that Boaz, who was one of the leaders at the time, it was not a conventional accepted thing that to marry a woman of Moab was okay. It was not clear that it would be okay. So for him to step up, and you see in the story we're about to read in chapter four, is that the person who is first in line to marrying Ruth in terms of the Levirate marriage was this guy John Doe. He pretty much, similar to what, in a sense, what Orpah was about, he's not unreasonable. If anything, it's actually very reasonable for him to say, "I'm not going to marry. I'm not touching this with a 10-foot pole." So let's read this story here. So meanwhile, Boaz had gone to the gate and sat down there, and now the redeemer whom Boaz had mentioned passed by. He called, "Come over and sit down here, so and so, John Doe, Ploni Almoni," and he came over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 elders of the town and said, "Be seated here." He brought a minion, and they sat down. He said to the redeemer, "Naomi, now returned from the country of Moab, must sell the piece of land which belonged to our kinsman Elimelech," that was Naomi's husband. "I thought I should disclose the matter to you and say, acquire it in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you are willing to redeem it, redeem." And the land, the inheritance, is connected to the idea of the one who's going to perform the Levirate marriage with Ruth. But if you will not redeem, tell me, and I may know. For there is no one to redeem but you, and I come after you. I am willing to redeem it, he replied. So Boaz continued, when you acquire the property from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabite, you must also acquire the wife of the deceased so as to perpetuate the name of the deceased upon his estate. The redeemer replied, then I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own estate. You take over my right of redemption, for I am unable to exercise it. So what he's saying here is, Plony Almoni, the guy who becomes known as John Doe forever, is worried that he's going to impair his, he's going to impair himself. Pen ashchit es nachlati, I'll impair my own estate, I'll impair my own name forever. What's funny about it, the irony is that it goes down in history as John Doe. He was worried about his name, and he ends up becoming, you know, Mr. Generic. We don't know who he is. He loses his name. Meanwhile, now this is what's going on in the text. Now this was formerly done in Israel in cases of redemption or exchange. To validate any transaction, one man should take off his sandal and hand it to the other. Such is the practice in Israel. And so when the redeemer said to Boaz, acquire it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and the rest of the people, you are witnesses today that I am acquiring from Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Mahlon and Chilion, the sons of Naomi. I am also acquiring Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, as my wife, so as to perpetuate the name of the deceased upon his estate, that the name of the deceased may not despair from among his kinsmen, and from the gate of his hometown, you are witnesses today. So he basically is saying that now Boaz is saying, I am willing to take this incredible responsibility. I'm actually going to step into a very controversial type of thing, because we see that he calls her Ruth the Moabite, right? He's saying, I am also acquiring Ruth the Moabite. Why does it do that? To again bring us to this idea that to marry a Moabite woman at that point was still not clear that that was okay. So it's like we're entering into, he's willing to put his neck out on the line. This is not a necessarily accepted practice, but he's saying this is okay. And he's not worried about his good name being impugned, which is funny, again, because the other guy, John Doe Plony Almoni, he ends up becoming, his name gets lost, right? It's the one who's not afraid to take this risk that his name becomes the one that we're talking about thousands of years later. All the people, not only that, it's from him that Mashiach will come. All the people at the gate and the elders answered, we are, may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel, prosper in Ephrata and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Peretz, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. So Boaz married Ruth. She became his wife, and he cohabited with her. The Lord let her conceive, and she bore a son. And the story continues. So I'm here today just to try to explain what the connection, or what's a message that's coming out from the story of Ruth that ties us into the acceptance of the Torah at Sinai. Like, what's it messaging us? So I'll give you two stories, two examples of people. One is Ruth and one is Boaz, who go above and beyond. We call it Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. When a person goes beyond what they were asked to do, it's for only one reason. It's because there's something that there's an understanding, there's a connection, there's an ability. When we are able to go beyond ourselves, it's because we have we connect to it. We have a love for something. We understand. We see the truth of it. We understand. Like, just listen to like Ruth's words. It's so powerful when she says, "Your people are my people." Like, she had such a love for her mother-in-law. She saw something in her mother-in-law that was so real. You're talking about a woman who's coming from royalty. Ruth was not just some, you know, beggar in the street. She came from the kings of Moab, right? She's a princess. But she sees something in her mother-in-law, Naomi, that speaks to her, that she wants to be part of. If this is what the Jewish people are about, I want to be with this person. It comes from a recognition of that truth, and so therefore she's able to go above and beyond anything that would be normal, not normally expected. The same of Boaz. The fact that he's willing to risk his good name and to step up and marry the Moabite woman, but he saw something in Ruth. He understood that I didn't bring it down here, but it said, he said, he thanks her, and he followed her story, where she came, she gave up her lineage, her think about it. She left the land of Moab, where she was a princess, to be dragged with Naomi back to this place where she was bitter at that point of loss, basically, because of the love that she had. He saw this woman as incredible in terms of her willingness to sacrifice for what she saw as truth. And he understood that, and he in turn, it gave him this willingness to sacrifice as well. So what we see here, this incredible lesson of the book of Ruth, at least just on this level, is the love. Is when a person has a dedication to things, it gives us the ability to become that much more. And when we talked about the Torah, when we come to the Torah and receiving the Torah from God, it's not a normal, it cannot be just a regular relationship. It has to be modeled similar to what we see with Ruth and with Boaz, this idea of connecting to something on such a deep level that it speaks to us in such a in such a deep way to us that what comes out of it is a devotion to it that it allows us to really go beyond what would be the normal expectations, but it's based on, it's predicated on love, so that when we go back to this original question of the connection between Mount Sinai, the revelation, and this reading of the book of Ruth. So one of the rabbis is going back already to Medrash times, that's going back to early Mishnah, is that it's the book of Ruth is all about kindness. But a kindness that's coming from a space of a place of love, a place of dedication and devotion that leads us to doing more than would be expected. But there's another element here that is, I'll just give you a little bit of a taste of it, because in the background, what's something strange, but one of the backdrops of the story, and it's mentioned here in the context of Boaz and what's going on there with the Levirate marriage. The Levirate marriage basically says that if someone dies without a child, that they're expecting the closest relative to come and marry and have a child to be able to allow the deceased's name to be extended. So in a way, the person who steps in and fills the shoes of the deceased is going to sacrifice their identity for the identity of the deceased. The fact that the royalty, the monarchy of the Jewish people, is built on multiple examples of Levirate marriage, it actually is integral to the creation of what a Jewish king is. Because what it means is if you're saying that we have multiple examples of someone willing to give up their own identity for the identity of someone else, because you know what? That's what a Jewish king is. Jewish king, King David. When we look at the Psalms, a lot of times you'll read the Psalms and you'll say, wow, that really, like, it spoke to me. How can that work for hundreds and thousands of people have the same reaction when they read the Psalms? It's because King David, as king, as a Jewish king, he sacrificed his own identity to become the identity of the people. A monarch, when a true king, is he sacrifices his own personal identity and becomes the identity of the people. So the idea of Levirate marriage is exactly that. You're willing to give up yourself and your own name for the other person, okay? That's what's going on in the background of this story, and it's brought with other examples of multiple, and it could be, you would even say, that Lot, all the way back at the beginning there, might have also been willing to sacrifice a little bit of his identity. He's doing a little bit of Levirate. Who knows? I'm not sure if we go that far. But this idea of giving up one's own identity for the others, that's Jewish monarchy. So that when King David writes the Psalms, he's us. So when you pick up the Psalms, that's our Jewish monarch. He wrote it as for us. He wrote it for the people. So you're connecting to that. But what is the Jewish monarch? He is David. David is Yadid, is my lover, is this idea that now brings us back to what we started with, that if the whole backdrop of the book of Ruth is to get us to connect us back, or to connect us to the lineage of King David, who was born on Shavuot, what does it have to do with the giving of the Torah? It's that when we got married to God, it was at Mount Sinai. The revelation was, the rabbis describe it as kind of a wedding. We became connected to God. It was this intense event where we became connected to God through his Torah. And so it has to be the nature, the what should come out of that is that we should develop a relationship with the Torah that is a love relationship. It cannot just be some kind of law book that you take off the, you know, the shelf, you read a little bit and you're like, okay, if my car hits someone else's car and I owe them $20, you know, like, it's about the whole totality of the Torah. God gave over himself in the Torah to us. So that the nature of our relationship with Torah has to be that of a love affair. And that it's something like we see expressed with Ruth, with Naomi, and with Boaz, what he does in the gate there with the elders, is that he's willing and she's willing to both, they both go beyond what would be normally expected. And it only comes because of a love, of a devotion for something that's beyond. And then one other piece here, and what I think what Ruth saw about Naomi is, and what Boaz saw about Ruth is that these people were willing to go beyond. They weren't trying to control events as much as they allowed the events to go and then became, they emerged and became who they became because of their love. So that Ruth becomes this person who becomes the mother of Jewish royalty, to the mother of Mashiach. It's like, you understand who this woman was? Why? Because of that love, that she was willing to like let things happen. She rolled with the punches. She, you understand, she came back to being destitute because she saw something. She had devotion to letting, like, saw this beauty in Naomi, this something that she was taken by. She saw something that led her on this path, and she was willing to let it become and let herself become. The rabbis tell us that her story is very similar to someone else in our history. His name was Abraham, who God said, I want you to go, lech lecha, I want you to go from your land, from the place of your comfort, and go to this place I'm going to show you. So Ruth's similar type of thing. She went from her homeland to a place that was going to become. God's directive to us and to Abraham was, lech lecha, I want you to go to become you. Ruth went and became who she was going to become, the mother of the Messiah, because she was willing to let go and to just live life and dedicated with love to something that was, she understood was truth, and then to like give her total self to that, and willing to risk everything, and then by that was able to become incredible. And so what the connection of the book to this special day of the revelation is to understand that we have to relate to the Torah and to God in the same way that our mother Ruth did, in the way she was able to go beyond, but it's predicated on the love. And that if we are able to somehow then come to learning of Torah and to connect to Torah and to God with this special devotion, but predicated on love of wanting to see what's real and to not like be stuck in whatever worlds we're stuck in, but to be able to like go past that, to be lifnimishor sadin, is to go past what's expected. And we can do that when we say, oh, I'm devoted to it because it's coming from a place of devotion and love. And so this is just a couple of ideas of the Book of Ruth. There's a lot more, but this, I think, hopefully helps us connect to the upcoming holiday and to understand how, when we look at this story, how we're supposed to take this incredible power of these people and draw from it. These are our ancestors. These are our, you know, our forefathers and foremothers and matriarchs and patriarchs that taught us that kind of let, you know, laid down the path. But through that, we're able to, like, you know, if we can take that lesson and then use it and apply it to our own lives, then I think that it will enhance our connection to the Torah, to God, and appreciation of, and then hopefully take it and become the most that we can become of ourselves.